Good evening, and thanks for coming. And welcome also to those of you watching on the internet. This talk is based on some of the themes contained in my new book, The Mythology of Eden. And in order to help you understand my presentation better, I should explain the approach that I take in the book. The book has mythology in its title because, as mentioned in the quotes on the screen, the Eden story lies within the genre of myth. So, by using the term myth, I'm focusing not on whether the story is factually true, but rather on how the story is constructed, which is in the manner of myth, using symbols as its building blocks in order to convey truths. I believe that our understanding of the story can be enhanced and enriched by a greater focus on the mythological symbolism that it utilizes, hence the book's title. More specifically, with reference to tonight's theme, I'm stressing that where a myth communicates through the use of veiled symbols rather than through direct explanation in words, it has an esoteric quality. In order to understand the myth, you need to understand the symbols. These days, the meaning of the symbols in the Eden story to its original audience has been reduced to a faint glimmer. So that meaning is what I've endeavored to restore in my book and we'll talk about tonight. Two more introductory points. Like most mythologists, I take the psychological approach to myths pioneered by Carl Jung, which is reflected in the quote here from Alan Watts. I recognize that real myths and their symbols originate in the unconscious part of the human psyche. They're shaped by common patterns called archetypes that evolved in the human psyche. That's why the same symbols with similar meanings appear the world over, and why so many myths have the same motifs. Secondly, we never meet 100% pure myth. In being told and retold, a myth is processed and changed by our conscious minds. Further, in works like the Bible, the myths and their symbols are being used intentionally for polemical purposes. In the Eden story, as we'll see, the original meanings of the symbols have been turned around by the author in order to make his argument. In order to illustrate the esoteric nature of the material in the Eden story, today I'll focus on two aspects of it, which I've chosen because my conclusions about them differ radically to what we've all been taught. The first topic I call Yahweh's divorce, and it has to do with how the author utilized the symbols of the garden, sacred trees, and the serpent to polemicize against Canaanite religion and its chief goddess, who was actually the wife of the Israelite god Yahweh. The second topic is, what's the nature of the knowledge of good and evil and of the transgression in the garden? And does it have anything, really, to do with the Christian doctrine of original sin? I'll begin the first topic with some literary and historical background. First, who's our author? We don't know his name, but scholars call him the Yahwist, J for short, because he was the first biblical author to call God by the name Yahweh. He's our earliest biblical author. Now, there are two creation stories in Genesis, and you have to keep them separate. First, we have Genesis 1, which is the famous six-day creation story, and that was authored by a writer we call P for Priestley, because he was always concerned with the prerogatives of priests and laws and stuff like that. Genesis 2 and 3 is the Eden story, and that's a separate creation story. They differ in a number of respects. First, the order of creation in the two stories differs. In Genesis 1, we have first plants, then animals, and then men and women simultaneously, and probably more than just one couple. In the Eden story, however, we have Adam, the first man, then the plants, then the animals who were initially created to possibly be one of his mate, and when that didn't work out, the first woman was created, Eve. The two authors also use different names for God. P uses Elohim, which is a generic word for God, and J uses Yahweh. Also, in the two stories, human nature, our makeup, differs. The lofty notion that man is created in the image of God appears only in Genesis 1 and is absent from the Eden story, in which humans are not nearly so elevated. In the Eden story, humans are made from dirt and return to dirt when they die. And a major point in the Eden story is that humans should not try to be like God because humans and God are fundamentally different. A final difference that we should note is that even though Genesis 1 comes first in the Bible, the Eden story was actually the earlier of the stories to be written, probably by about 200 years. And so that makes it important not to interpret the Eden story through the lens of Genesis 1. Now for some historical background. The archaeology shows that Israel emerged from within Canaan in the highlands of what is now the West Bank, and it spread from there. So originally, the Israelites were really mostly native Canaanites. This means that their own religious traditions were those of Canaanite polytheism. The Bible paints this picture of the Hebrews escaping from Egypt in the Exodus, adopting Yahweh as their single deity, and then conquering the Promised Land and exterminating most of the Canaanites. But the archaeologists have been all over this, and they found no evidence for it. The Bible portrays the Canaanites and their gods as foreign enemies, but the real story is more like the old line from Pogo: we have met the enemy, and he is us. Further, Yahweh was not among the deities originally worshipped by the Canaanites who became the Israelites. He was imported into Israel by groups from the south in the Midian. You recall in the Bible, when Moses first escaped from Egypt after killing the slave, he goes to the Midian, and that's where he meets Jethro, and he marries his daughter, and that's where he sees the burning bush. So that's the area that we're talking about. And to that extent, the biblical story of Moses has some historical truth to it. Now, this point is important because it means that the effort to establish monotheism entailed the Israelites exorcising their own religious traditions rather than staying away from, quote, foreign ones. These traditions involve such things as venerating sacred trees, serpents, and goddesses who were paired with their husband gods. And this is exactly what pops up in the Eden story. So now we can turn to the author's agenda. One of Jay's major themes is Canaanite bashing. Leaving aside the Eden story for a moment, we see Jay striking up this polemic most explicitly in his story of Noah's drunkenness, where Canaan is cursed. Jay then lays it out more specifically here in Exodus, in the first of the Ten Commandments, which is actually authored by Jay. Here, Jay rages against Canaanite altars, stone pillars, Asherah poles, all found in Canaanite religious sanctuaries. An Asherah was a wooden pole, kind of like a totem pole, that was a stylized tree. It was the cult object of the goddess Asherah, who was Yahweh's wife, and it was named after her, and it became her symbol. She was worshipped using this cult object, much like Christians use the cross, which also was thought of as a tree. So now I'm going to go through some of the symbols. Now, first is the garden itself, and then I'm going to talk about a trinity of the goddess, the sacred trees, and the serpent, which overlap and work together. As an introduction to this, we see an Egyptian example of this. Here we have the goddess in the tree goddess. It's Nut, as it says down here. And we have the serpent right here in an erect posture, semi-erect, guarding both the goddess and the tree. And the tree, of course, is sacred. So here's what I'm going to tell you. Jay portrayed Yahweh as the sole repository of divinity having powers over all the cosmos. Therefore, he had to eliminate and appropriate the powers of the Canaanite divinities. This included eliminating Asherah, whom Yahweh had inherited from the Canaanite god El as his consort or wife. In the Eden story, Jay arranged their divorce and sent the goddess into oblivion. Now I'll go through some highlights of the evidence for this. First, the garden. In the earliest civilizations, the goddess governed vegetation and life. People partook of the first crops as her bounty and her body, and set up her sanctuary in a garden of crops for this purpose. At the heart of this garden was a sacred tree. And we see this in several examples. One is in the Epic of Gilgamesh, where we have Siduri's vineyard with a sacred tree. In Sumer, we have Inanna's garden precinct with a sacred tree, and in the myth of the Hulupu tree. In Homer's Odyssey, we have Calypso's vineyard. And in ancient Greece, we have both the Garden of the Hesperides, which is an orchard of Hera, and the Dodona sanctuary, also of an earth goddess Dione, which equals Gaia, where they had a sacred oak tree. Asherah as a goddess in Israel is now established in mainstream archaeology and biblical scholarship. She originated in Mesopotamia, and in Canaan, she became El's wife, and then she was inherited by Yahweh when El and Yahweh merged. The Hebrew Bible mentions Asherah and Asherah poles some 40 times. Most references are to the wooden pole, the cult object that symbolized Asherah and bore her name. However, several references, shown on the slide, clearly refer to Asherah, the goddess. Another piece of interesting biblical evidence is that an Asherah pole stood in front of Solomon's temple for about two-thirds of its existence before it was destroyed. There's also significant extra-biblical evidence of Asherah in Syria-Palestine over many centuries from the late Bronze Age into the Iron Age. I can't go over all of this on the slide here. I did it in my book. So here I'm going to focus on the inscriptions and some of the iconography. The first inscription from Israel is an 8th century blessing formula for a rich man or governor who just died, named Uriah, which mentions Yahweh and his Asherah, quote, "Here Yahweh appears to be using Asherah's cult object, the Asherah pole, thus drawing on the goddess's powers in addition to his own." Even more interesting are three inscriptions found in the Sinai. The first of these, highlighted in red here, is an important link because in Samaria, which was the capital of the northern kingdom of Israel, an Asherah pole stood in Yahweh's own sanctuary, just as one stood in front of the Jerusalem temple. So Yahweh and Asherah were seen as being paired in Samaria as well. So to summarize so far, Asherah is paired with Yahweh as his consort. Asherah is present with Yahweh in his sanctuaries. Thus, this would be expected in Yahweh's Garden of Eden sanctuary too. Jay opposes Asherah and must deal with the above, so divorce is in order. Jay must have Yahweh appropriate the powers of the goddess so she can be dispensed with. This is shown by how Jay treats the goddess symbols in the Eden story. The garden must be shown to be Yahweh's sanctuary, not that of the goddess, where only he is divine and he's in control. So now let's turn to these other symbols. First of all, the sacred trees. And here I should explain how people thought of trees long ago. The cosmos consisted of three tiers. One was where we are now, the land, the sea. And then below was the netherworld, which was a divine realm. There were deities there. And then above in the sky or in the heavens, that was also a divine realm where there were also deities. And trees are unique, in that they span all three tiers. We see them on the earth, but their roots go down into the earth, into the underworld, and therefore can access that divine realm. Likewise for the heavens, that their branches reach into the sky, and therefore trees can actually be conduits of divinity. And it means that people can access divinity through the sacred trees. And that's why you end up getting sacred tree veneration in the ancient world. Also, in harmony with the seasons, trees embody the life energy and symbolize the generation, regeneration, and renewal of life. Therefore, they're associated with a source of life, the goddess. Now, I think we've gone far enough where we can start going through some of the archaeology here to illustrate what I mean. Here on the left, we have what we call the branch goddess. She has an Egyptian headdress, but she's holding the branches of the tree, and you see here her underwear, if you will, is made out of branches as well, and that's her reproductive area, of course. And over here, we have another pendant. This is a scarab, actually. This is a pendant. And you see, this is Egyptian style, too. This is a Hathor hairstyle, goddess Hathor. And there you see parts of her body and her pubic triangle. And guess what? The tree's growing right out of it. So that symbolism is pretty obvious. Here again in color is the Egyptian tree goddess. Same goddess, Nut. And so there we go with that. This one's interesting to show just how far this goes back, this motif. This is from Sumer. And Here we have the sacred tree being accessed by animals. The caprids were thought to be very fertile, so I think this is more of a fertility theme. But the tree is not merely a sacred tree, but it's also a symbol of the goddess, because here we have the goddess taking the place of the tree between the animals, and she's actually holding the vegetation to symbolize that here. Most of the specialists have identified this as Asherah. This is from Ugarit, which is on the Mediterranean coast in Syria. So this is about 14th century BC. Now this one's even more interesting. This was just a little later from Lachish, which is southwest of Jerusalem. These two pieces were found in the same stratum, so they were really pretty much the same time and probably may have been even used together. Over here, you see the two animals on either side of the tree. One of them's a bit cut off. And here's the tree in the middle. And what's interesting here is that over top of it in Old Hebrew is the word Elat, which means the goddess. And Elat was an epithet for Asherah. And so here you see the tree being identified with the goddess. The symbols are interchangeable. And then over here, it's interesting too, because again, we have the two animals, but guess what? In place of the tree, we have the goddess's the pubic triangle of the goddess. So again, it shows the interchangeability of the symbols. And then another point which is interesting is here. Does that resemble something that you mean? Yeah, menorah. Seven-branch tree, which is what Yahweh told Moses to create in Exodus. And so here we have in 1200 BC this symbol before that Bible episode was ever written. It was in the iconography already. Okay, another inscription. This is the same one I mentioned before, only next to it is a drawing. And this is interesting because here we have, again, the two animals with the goddess slash tree in the middle, and it refers to Asherah. So we're not sure that the person who wrote this is the same person that drew this, but whoever was the second was making this connection. And here you see the tree is rather stylized, but that's, you know, an Asherah pole was stylized too. It was a stylized tree. So you end up with this hybrid image. Okay, now we can turn to the serpent symbol and the relation of the serpent to the goddess. Serpent symbolism the world over is very complicated, but for now I want to focus on the fact that serpents have positive and negative, or good and evil, aspects. The serpent represented, the good serpent I'm talking about first, represented the creative divine force, the life energy. And the serpent, accordingly, was venerated as divine in Palestine. The serpent is also chthonic, from within the earth, like the earth goddess. It accesses and lives in the divine plane of the netherworld. It guards trees and is associated with their roots. Remember the Egyptian image that I showed? The serpent sheds its slough, its skin, and hibernates, and so is a symbol of renewal and eternal life. And accordingly, serpents and their slough were used in a fertility rites. Serpents are also associated with divination and are sources of knowledge and wisdom. The noun for serpent, nahash in Hebrew, connotes divination, and the verb nahash means to practice divination or observe signs. And therefore, you can see already a connection between the serpent and the acquisition of the knowledge of good and evil in the story. Now, the serpent has some negative characteristics too, and both the positive and the negative characteristics are reflected in the Eden story. The serpent represented the unrestrained aspect of the divine force too. Typical of primordial chaos, which I'll talk about later, and this is evil. Therefore, in creation myths, often a serpent or dragon is fought and defeated so that the ordered cosmos, which is good, can be created. This is called the dragon fight motif. This evil serpent is usually a serpent goddess or her proxy. So in the Eden story, the serpent connoted chaos and symbolized the chaos in Eve's heart or psyche. So let's look at a few more symbols here. Actually, the determinative hieroglyph in Egyptian for goddess is a serpent like this. It's the erect cobra. And here too, we have Isis and Nephthys as serpents. This is Nephthys here, Isis here. And they're going to rescue Ra. Now this one's real interesting because we see the Trinity again. We have the sacred tree, goddess, and the serpent behind the goddess. Note that the serpent is standing erect on its tail. It means that the divine energy is flowing through it. Think of Kundalini. In the ancient Near East, the good serpent is usually portrayed in an erect posture like here, whereas the evil serpent is usually horizontal. We see both in the Eden story. At first, the serpent is somehow erect in its traditional posture when talking with Eve, more or less at eye level, and then it is flattened by Yahweh as its punishment. This is a famous lady. I don't have to explain much here. It's from Crete. She's called the serpent goddess. Now, this one's interesting because, again, it shows the interchangeability of the symbols. It's the same goddess we saw before in an image about a dozen images ago. Same place, too. But here, between the animals, she's holding serpents instead of the wheat or barley. So there you go. That's the goddess. And again, most people think this is Asherah. Astarte was associated with, these are hooved animals, I think, you know, maybe horses rather than goats. But Astarte's association with horses came later. This is too early for that. This one's really interesting. In Ugarit, Asherah was associated with the Egyptian goddess Hathor because Egypt dominated that area at the time. So she has Hathor's hairstyle like in the pendant that we saw before. And here she's depicted, this time she's holding the capers up here. So they're still there. But she has serpents running through her reproductive area here, symbolizing the role in the generation of life. Now here are two examples of serpents symbolizing the divine powers inhering in and flowing through the sacred tree. On the left, we have a tree, and the foliage is depicted in the manner of the erect cobra, Uraeus, from Egypt. And here on the right, we have a seated figure, maybe goddess, we're not quite sure. The sacred tree in the middle, the two figures here substitute for the capers that you see in a lot of the other motifs. And then above the tree, we have Uraei, and then this actually is Hathor, again, in bovine form. So that one's really a crowded image with a lot in it. Now, lastly, let's talk about how Eve represents the goddess Asherah, a fact that has been recognized by a number of scholars, as shown on the slide here. One reason for this is that Eve is given the title, quote, mother of all living at the end of the story. And this essentially repeats epithets given to goddesses, including Asherah herself. So that's all over the ancient Near East. The second reason is that Eve's name in Hebrew, Hava, is related to Hebrew and other Semitic words meaning serpents and life. In light of what we've been discussing, this ties Eve to the goddess. All right, having reviewed the symbols, however briefly, we can sum up and see how the quote-unquote fall in the Eden story is actually not the one we are familiar with. Rather, it is the fall of the goddess and her symbols. In the story, Jay changed the traditional meanings of these symbols in order to divorce Yahweh and Asherah and send her into oblivion. And there are five points, actually, that I want to make in conclusion here on the first topic. First, with regard to the sacred trees, Jay is linking the sacred trees with the serpent and the goddess using this traditional mythological trinity that I've mentioned. The tree of knowledge of good and evil is something that he rejects because it represents experiencing divinity through sacred tree veneration, and therefore of the goddess too. But Yahweh claims the tree of life, his cherubim and sword guarded at the end of the story. And we can see this kind of thinking. Yahweh is taking over this aspect of divinity, divine power, where he says, Hey, I'm it. I'm like an evergreen cypress. From me comes your fruit. As for the serpent, it falls too and is demythologized. And at the end of the story, it's cursed and made the lowest of all animals. It's going to crawl on its belly, as opposed to the prior erect posture that I talked about before. It's going to eat dust from now on. This may be an echo, actually, of the serpent-dragon fight that I mentioned before motif, only with here Yahweh is the victor. Serpents and humans are made enemies at the end of the story. This constitutes anti-Canaanite polemic designed to prevent dangerous veneration of serpents and break up the Canaanite cultic partners of women and serpent. In the end, the ground outside the garden is cursed. Traditionally, the earth was the chthonic province of the serpent and the goddess, who together made it fertile. Yahweh takes over this function. He created the plants in the garden. Okay, as for the goddess, Eve slash Asherah, Yahweh, not the goddess, becomes the creator here, unlike in the traditional mythology. Eve, the goddess, is created by Yahweh here, and she emerges from the male human and is made of his substance. The creative roles have been reversed. Goddess is also infertile. Just after the Eden story, Eve needs Yahweh's help to conceive in Genesis 4:1. And once she conceives, she's going to have her pregnancy and give birth in pain and toil, whereas in the ancient Near East, goddesses did so without pain. Eve's actions parallel the serpent's. Mythologically, both were mediators. The serpent convinces her, and she likewise lures the male into pagan worship. Think of Solomon and Jezebel, wives of Solomon and Jezebel. The only fault in the story of Adam, really, if you read it, is that he listened to Eve in order to attain these divine qualities. This may be an allusion to goddess veneration, saying not to venerate her. This is one reason at the end of the story for the woman's subjugation to man. As for the garden sanctuary, it's Yahweh's. Remember I said that traditionally the garden was that of the goddess? Here in the story, it's Yahweh. It's his garden, he made it, and he dominates it at the end, even though there's trouble in the middle of the story. So he's in control of the former precinct of the goddess, and it's symbolized at the end by his cherubim and sword guarding it. At the end, chaos is eliminated, and the original perfection of the garden is restored, but only within the garden. Outside the garden, the cosmos is tainted with some chaos, which will grow throughout the primeval history, culminating in the flood, after which the curse on the ground will finally be removed. Finally, these major aspects of the Eden story have nothing to do with Christian themes, but rather consist of polemic aimed against Canaanite goddess veneration and the Yahweh-Asherah relationship. Nevertheless, in Christianity, the goddess, or the feminine principle theme, inevitably arises in due course, just as in other religions. Initially in the women around Jesus in the gospel accounts, in the Acts of Paul and Thecla, and later in the veneration of the Virgin Mary. Psychologically, this is because the feminine principle is part of the self, and naturally it will not be repressed or suppressed for long. Jung understood the Christ figure as a symbol of the self. Okay, let's turn to topic two, and that is the nature of the knowledge of good and evil, what was the transgression about, and does it have anything to do with the Christian doctrine of original sin? You might want to take a deep breath here. You'll need it. This topic is a little shorter, but it's more dense. Here we need to start at the beginning, at the creation. In the biblical world, there was no such thing as creation from nothing. Rather, there was always a pre-existing primordial substance that was chaotic, not in the sense that it was necessarily violent, although it was at times, but in the sense that it was formless and lacked order. Ancient peoples thought of creation not as bringing any new substance into being, but as bringing the pre-existing substance into order, which brought about multiplicity, time, rational space, cause and effect, and distinctions, especially opposites. The creation of something was complete only when the creator gave it a name connoting its nature, purpose, function, and destiny. Thus, Adam's name came from the Hebrew Adamah, meaning ground or earth, because he was made of the ground, and he was destined to till the soil. Eve's name, as we've seen, connoted life. In the Eden story, The pre-existing chaos was depicted as a desert wasteland called Eden. That's around the garden, not in it. The Hebrew Bible and other ancient Near Eastern texts often describe the desert as a manifestation of chaos. That's why the Hebrews spent 40 years in the wilderness after they sinned. So as one biblical scholar put it, in Genesis 1, chaos is pictured as a sea, in Genesis 2 as a desert. Now, after the creation, this is what we have. And you'll have to visualize this in three dimensions. We have where we are is the land, and then we have this the atmosphere. And then as part of the creation, there's a division, which is called the firmament between the created cosmos, which is this semicircle, and the chaotic waters. And the whole thing is surrounded by the chaotic waters. And then the same primordial chaotic waters that were there before the creation. In the middle, we just have an island or bubble, which is the created cosmos, and that's where the order is. Everything around it is chaotic and disorderly. And on the firmament, you can see the heavenly bodies are hung. So here we see what the priestly writer meant in Genesis 1:6, when he said, "Let there be a dome in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters." The primordial chaotic waters still surrounded the created cosmos. So we might ask, why did creation myths conceive of the creation as order emerging from chaos? Well, it's one example of how myths emerge from the psyche. Psychologists such as Marie-Louise von Franz argue that this cosmogony is a natural result of our psyche experiencing its own ego consciousness coming into being as, quote, world becoming. That is, from the perspective of our psyche, our becoming aware of the world and the world coming into existence are one and the same. This process occurred not only when early humans first developed ego consciousness, but also occurs, as developmental psychology shows, in any young child's psychological development, as well as in the daily life of adults, as when we wake up in the morning. Every time we transition from an unconscious state into waking ego consciousness, we experience the orderly developments of the world falling into place, time, space, cause and effect, and so forth. Thus, the dawn of consciousness and the creation of the world are parallel and related processes which throw up the same symbolism. The emergence of our ego consciousness projects itself in cosmic form. Cosmogonic myths thus portray the coming of this consciousness through corresponding symbols. Our unconscious has little sense of space or time and therefore little sense of order. It is indeed chaotic and is experienced as such. Hence, water is a well-known archetypal symbol for the unconscious. Thus, too, the notion of a primordial chaotic waters is a natural archetypal symbolic projection of an image that helps make the unknown comprehensible. Only our conscious ego can put order to the initially chaotic content of our psyches, meaning quite literally that, from the perspective of our psyche, the creation of the outside world can occur only when and as we cross the border from unconsciousness into ego consciousness. Now, in the ancient Near Eastern thinking, the creation in the created cosmos is inherently unstable. The chaos is never really eliminated. It's always trying to infiltrate from the outside and disrupt the ordered cosmos. And as a result, the cosmos is inherently unstable. As one professor, John Levinson, expressed this, quote, "The confinement of chaos rather than its elimination is the essence of creation, and the survival of ordered reality hangs only upon God's vigilance in ensuring that those cosmic dikes do not fail." The world is not inherently safe, it's inherently unsafe. Likewise, Professor Blenkinsop from Notre Dame observed in his study of the primeval history that, quote, "There can be no creation, however good, without allowing for the possibility of disorder, deviance, and evil." Now, this chaos is usually symbolized by a serpent or dragon, which must be vanquished for this cosmos to be created. So when the serpent appears in the garden, the audience knows that chaos has appeared and is threatening the orderly creation. The serpent and Eve's dialogue with it, as reflected in the imaginings of her mind, are representative of the chaos that has erupted in her mind. Since in these creation stories, nothing is fully created until a deity has given it a name and a destiny and a purpose, The elements of the cosmos have a teleological, i.e. purposeful, nature. In Adam's case, as I already mentioned, his purpose was and destiny, and hence that of humankind, was linked with the earth itself. Adam's decreed task was both to cultivate and guard and preserve the garden. In cosmic terms, this was an assignment to preserve and further develop the divinely created order. And this is exactly what he and Eve failed to do. This teleological character of creation and the instability of the cosmos set up a conflict between chaos and order. God wants order, which is good, which is why he so characterized his creations in Genesis 1. Chaos threatens order and therefore is evil. The battle between order and chaos thus has a normative character. In ancient times, when chaos erupted on Earth in the form of earthquakes, destructive storms, tsunamis, etc., people considered them evil because they create disorder and to some extent undo the creation. This dynamic has implications for human conduct. Humans must behave consistently with God's created order and desires. Acting in a way that increases chaos is wrongful and is the essence of sin. Sin is literally the manifestation of chaos in human conduct. That's how it can be defined. Let's talk about the chaos within humans. This cosmic battle between chaos and order naturally goes on within human beings, within our psyches. This follows from how we are made. Specifically, when Adam was being formed from the earth, order did not yet exist on earth, only chaos. The garden had not yet been created. Adam was created from the substance of the chaotic Eden before the garden existed, and he was created as a combination of the chaotic desert wasteland soil and the chaotic primordial waters from the underworld, which Yahweh had just caused to spurt to the surface. Therefore, humans, just like all other elements of the cosmos, naturally have an element of chaos within themselves. Now, in order to elaborate on this point, I'll have to get a little technical for a minute or two. Jay gives this human element of chaos a designation, Yetzer in Hebrew, which is a feature of our nature even from youth. The second verse on the screen here, Genesis 8:21, is important because Yahweh says this at the end of Noah's flood when he's resigning himself to the fact that humans have this trait by nature, and therefore Yahweh covenants with Noah never to flood the earth again. The noun Yetzer comes from the verb Yatsar, which Jay uses to describe Yahweh's forming both Adam and the animals from the ground. Thus, Yetzer literally means that which is shaped or made. Accordingly, this inclination or impulse toward evil, Yetzer, is literally a formation within human nature, within our psyche. This accounts for the later rabbinical doctrine of our natural inclination or impulse to evil called the Yetzer Hara. In Judaism, this became the standard explanation for the origin and continuation of evil in the world, which of course is at odds with the Christian explanation of original sin, but is consistent with the approach that I'm proposing here. Specifically, this element of chaos, the inclination toward evil, existed from our very beginning, at Adam's creation, which is to say, before the transgression in the garden. Anticipating a bit, in modern psychological terms, we can begin to see how this chaos consists of unconscious content, especially shadow content, manifesting itself in human behavior. We see this playing out in the primeval history, which is from the Garden of Eden story to the Tower of Babel story in the Bible. Since humans' divine purpose is to further order, they must fight and suppress the chaos within themselves. This is what Yahweh counseled Cain about. Sin is lurking at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must master it. The failure to control the chaos in oneself results in sin and increases chaos in the world. The sins of human, in turn, can and will infect the rest of the world, causing further chaos. This concept is found in Hosea 3:3, where the prophet laments the consequences to Israel of not observing Yahweh's law. He writes, "Therefore the land mourns, and all who dwell in it languish, and also the beasts of the field, and the birds of the air, and even the fish of the sea are taken away." Thus, the historical decline of Israel from the ideal kingships of David and Solomon, leading to the exile, is portrayed as a deterioration into chaos. So this is what happened between Cain's sin and Noah's flood. Chaos snowballed until Yahweh was fed up, decided to start all over again with the cleansing of the flood, but then the same thing started happening. And this is a setup, because it explains what the remedy has to be, because the same thing started happening again. So Jay and the other biblical authors thought the solution was twofold. First, humans need to have the knowledge of good and evil and apply this knowledge in order to control chaos and avoid sin. But as the primeval history had just shown, having this knowledge in itself is not sufficient. Humans left on their own are not up to the task. Therefore, a second element from Yahweh is needed, namely, create and impose the law, the Torah, requiring the Hebrews to follow it. The law is a form of order, designed for humans to control chaos. But in order to understand and follow the law, the knowledge of good and evil must be applied. So the two elements are complementary and they have to work together. Now let's see what these two elements mean, beginning with the nature of the knowledge of good and evil. There's been much uncertainty over what the knowledge of good and evil really is, but in the Hebrew Bible, it's actually explained pretty well, and it has nothing to do with sex. This description begins in the Eden story, where this knowledge is acquired. When Eve saw the tree of knowledge of good and evil, she recognized that it was, quote, to be desired to make one wise, which was her principal interest in it. Then, once she and Adam ate the forbidden fruit, quote, the eyes of both were opened and they knew certain things. Observing this, Yahweh remarked, behold, the man has become like one of us, gods, knowing good and evil. This means that such godlike knowledge included wisdom and an ability to perceive, discern, and distinguish. The Hebrew Bible goes on to explain more specifically what the knowledge of good and evil means. It refers to men reaching an age of maturity at which they are deemed to, quote, know good and evil, and therefore may assume adult roles and responsibilities. Isaiah 7, verses 14 through 16 describes a stage in the growth of a child before, quote, he knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good, unquote. Similarly, rules in Hebrew law refer to the age of 20 as when men acquire certain rights and responsibilities, such as performing military service, giving offerings to Yahweh, and paying taxes. This is exemplified by when Yahweh cursed the children of Israel in the wilderness as punishment for doubting and murmuring against him. These responsibilities were imposed only on people 20 years of age and older, because only they were deemed capable of and responsible for sin. This interpretation is confirmed in Deuteronomy 1:39, which refers to these same exempted young people from the wilderness as those who, quote, have no knowledge of good and evil, unquote. Likewise, the Dead Sea Scrolls, in outlining the rules for a young man entering the congregation at Qumran, state that such entry shall occur when a male is 20 years of age when he knows good and evil. Only then can he take his place among the men of the clan, join the congregation, and have intercourse with women, and thus marry. In conclusion, the knowledge of good and evil is achieved at the stage of maturity at which one has the wisdom and discernment to understand and follow the law and tell right from wrong, and therefore have the ability to sin or not. In legalistic terms, the knowledge of good and evil is functionally equivalent to our modern legal principle of legal capacity, without which one is not legally responsible for one's actions. Kings, as leaders, must have the highest level of knowledge of good and evil, at least if they're going to be good kings. This is exemplified best by David and Solomon, whose wisdom is specifically described as the godlike ability to distinguish between good and evil. Thus, in conclusion, in the Israelite understanding, Adam and Eve's transgression was not the cause of the sinful nature of humans, as in the Christian doctrine of original sin. Rather, the transgression was the natural result of such nature that had existed from the moment of human creation in circumstances when human behavior was not yet subject to control by the knowledge of good and evil. Humans gaining such knowledge is what made it possible for Yahweh to warn Cain about sin as mentioned above, which was the first mention of sin in the Hebrew Bible. The presumed ability of Cain to understand and master sin assumes his knowledge of good and evil. Yahweh could not have said this to Adam and Eve because they would not have understood it. As Morton Buber explained, quote, "The deed of the first humans belonged to the sphere of pre-evil, Cain's deed to that of evil, which only came into being as such through the act of knowledge," unquote. But once humans acquired such knowledge, they had a meaningful power of choice and the responsibility to exercise that choice in favor of the good. This understanding allows us to understand the transgression itself. The symbol of primordial chaos in creation myths is really a projection of our own chaotic unconscious, while the mythological motif of creation as a process of imposing order reflects our own coming into ego consciousness, a self-aware knowing of the outside world. As such, Adam and Eve's eyes being open upon gaining the knowledge of good and evil, and immediately being able to see opposites, such as that they were naked and understand the difference between being clothed and being naked, symbolizes their transition from an archaic, undifferentiated psychic unity, sometimes called the Ouroboros, to a higher level. Through this transformation, humans became able to make subject-object distinctions, distinguish themselves in relation to the outside world, and perceive and understand the world in terms of opposites. This means not just those of good and evil, as in the story, but all opposites. This transformation brings us from a childlike state to maturity, where we are fully human and, among other things, can understand Yahweh and his law. It is the completion of our creation, after which we can walk out of the garden, i.e. our earlier psychic state, even on our own, just like the children of the wilderness when they were mature enough and ready to enter the promised land. Now, at this point, we might ask, why wasn't this knowledge, this software, already downloaded into humans at creation? After all, in P's creation account, it seems that humans were created with this knowledge. To answer this, we must approach the transgression from J's literary and rhetorical perspective, having in mind the narrative arc of the primordial history for which J was mainly responsible. I think that for the author, it was important to depict to the audience raw, chaotic human nature and what happens when this nature takes its natural course. It was important also for Adam and Eve to learn their lesson the hard way, so that they could experience firsthand both the pure chaos within themselves, which is evil, and then the coming of the corrective ordering knowledge, which is good. This, in turn, enables the audience to feel the same dynamic within themselves. Thus, a transgression was helpful for literary and rhetorical purposes. Thus, Jay's decision to so dramatize this transformation of the first humans turns the transgression into a kind of initiation scenario. Yahweh said to Adam, "Of the tree of knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat of it you shall die." But Adam and Eve did not physically die that day. Biblical scholars have long tried to explain this, and the usual interpretation is that Adam and Eve's life changed that day such that on that day they become destined to die. But the psychological interpretation makes possible a different kind of life change. Their transformation into this new full ego consciousness means that they have died to their former way of life, which is no more. This is essentially an initiation ceremony, which is esoteric. We see this kind of thing happening in the New Testament, where St. Paul describes the conversion to Christianity as a psychic transformation, whereby one becomes dead to one's former state of being and way of life. Romans 6:10, Paul speaks of dying to sin. Romans 7, verse 4, Paul speaks of dying to the law of Moses through Christ so as to belong to him. Similarly, in Galatians 2:19, Paul says, "I died to the law so that I might live in God." And then, on a slightly different angle, in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 36, Paul talks of that one must die in order to be resurrected into eternal life. Now, Before I conclude, I want to just reiterate the point about the second element of the solution, according to Jay and the other biblical writers, before I show you a diagram. The knowledge of good and evil is a necessary but not sufficient condition for reigning in our chaotic evil nature so that order and good will prevail. Therefore, the divine help is needed in the law. The law is a form of cosmic order, such that when it is understood and followed, order can be brought to human affairs. The law is therefore a creative principle because it helps bring order, good, to the part of the cosmos that is humankind. It is conceived of as a gift, the divine gift, not a burden. As the biblical scholar Gregory Mobley summarized this point, quote, God has given humans an instruction manual for life on planet Earth so that they can partner with God in the management of chaos. Now, we see these two principles depicted in this diagram. We look at on the cosmic level, like we talked about with the creation and everything, we have good being form or order, and then evil is chaos on the cosmic level. And then a subset of that is at the human level. And there, as I said, what is good is the law and following the law because it's orderly and will keep chaos in its place. Whereas evil is a form of chaos and sin is a form of chaos manifesting itself in the human psyche. Okay, the final slide. I want to talk about the relevance of the story today in a few aspects. First, on the doctrine of original sin, as we've seen, the transgression in the story has no relevance as the source of our sinful nature. We had that before. As we've seen, our nature that leads to sin is a built-in cosmic trait that was naturally part of us upon our creation. The Jews never interpreted their Eden story as one of a fall resulting in sinful nature. That notion was a creation of St. Paul. He created it in response to the embarrassment of the Messiah having been crucified, which was a stumbling block when seeking converts to Christianity. The Jews had expected their Messiah to be a powerful figure who would defeat the forces of evil, most particularly the Romans. But instead, the Romans executed him in the most humiliating way possible. And this only after the Jewish establishment had turned against him and turned him in. Further, Deuteronomy 21, verses 22-23, says that anyone executed on a tree is cursed by God. Since according to this scripture, Jesus was cursed, how could he be the Messiah? Paul had to get around these problems. He solved it by rationalizing as follows. Since Jesus was righteous and sinless, yet bore a curse, he must have borne a curse that was originally on others because of their sins. In this way, he sacrificed himself for all humankind, enabling them to die to sin and to their former sinful nature, and eventually to obtain eternal life. And in order to explain how people can escape sinfulness and death, Paul had to explain why we have a sinful nature and die in the first place. And he found his answer in the Eden story. So we read in Romans 5:12, therefore, just as sin came into the world through one man, and death came through sin, so death spread through all men, because of which all have sinned. And again in 1 Corinthians 15, 21, 22, for as death came through a human being, so too through a human being shall transpire the resurrection of the dead. For as all die in Adam, so too all will be made alive in Christ. But as we've seen, rather than being the story of our fall, the Eden story is about the elevation of human consciousness. Having the knowledge of good and evil is a necessary and good thing. Once gaining this higher mental capacity, Adam and Eve were prepared, in effect, to walk out of the garden on their own. The garden is really a metaphor for our minds. The implication is that we should continue to elevate our consciousness. That's something we can do today. Two smaller points. The story, of course, denigrated women and the feminine principle, and this story has been used for centuries to repress women, and obviously that has to stop. It's starting to stop, but in a lot of pockets, it's still there, and we have to hammer away at that. On the positive side, however, the story has good, relevant environmental themes. Humanity's task was to cultivate, guard, and preserve the garden, which is the Earth. And these days, when we're facing climate change and a lot of other environmental challenges, this is a good thing that the story has to offer for us.
This is very interesting. I have two quick ones. First, is there a translation of the Bible that you find the most useful for this type of study?
For most purposes and most stories, I like best the New Revised Standard Version. When I was doing the book, I learned Hebrew, so I was able to read it, and I did my own translation of the whole primeval history. And when I was doing that, of course, I referred to the various translations in English, and none of them was satisfactory in every respect. So what I would urge anyone is, if you're really going to look at the story seriously, look at the various translations.
Okay.
In the handout, what I gave you is actually the New Revised Standard Version, except that I put in Yahweh when it said God in the translation, and I also gave some of the Hebrew terminology for you. And the second question?
A quick one. A couple of the images had a lion at the bottom under the tree, and I just wondered why under the tree?
Yeah. It's under the tree because it's under the goddess. The lions are often associated with goddesses because the goddess is originally represented the divine force, you know, that creates things, life and so forth. But the divine force, as I showed in the case of the serpent, has a violent aspect to it as well. And so sometimes goddesses were portrayed as being very violent and powerful, and that's why you get some of the goddesses being war goddesses. And so you see the goddess standing on the lion because it shows that she's powerful.
Earlier you mentioned the knowledge of good and evil and what it represented. I wasn't sure if judgment was on the list. Do you think judgment plays a role in that?
You mean the knowledge of good and evil gives you the capacity to judge, or that there's some other judgment going on? I'm not quite sure what you mean.
Well, the idea I had was that God forbade humans to eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil in order to spare them judgment and all the things that could result from judging things or judging other people.
No, I wouldn't say he set it up that way. I think the point is that in respect of any judgment, I think, is that before they got the knowledge, they really didn't really have the capacity to make good judgments. Adam and Eve didn't. And so once you have the knowledge, you can do that, and you need a little help from Yahweh in respect to the law. But you also have real choice then. And in other words, you have a basis on which to make a judgment because you have this mental capacity now.
I think a little bit of a problem that we approach when studying materials like this is if we start taking the Bible too literally, we'll assume, for instance, that death came about because of this alleged transgression, and yet half the world doesn't posit that at all. For instance, in Buddhism and Taoism, they posit the inherent instability and transience of all things. So you don't have to come up with a just-so story of a fall and transgression. I came across a book, I didn't buy it, but I just skimmed through it, written from a fundamentalist Christian point of view, which discussed how did God plan to take care of overpopulation before the fall? And, you know, questions like that, you know, arise only if you take a very literalist approach in the first place.
Sure.
Instead of looking at, for instance, this whole story as a overarching theme of involution and evolution. And there's a great parallel with the parable of the prodigal son, involution. And then when you learn your lessons, you know, you go back to the father, or evolution. So at a certain point, we look at scriptures not with a jaundiced eye, but very critically, and then maybe, as the Zen Buddhists do, just avoid scriptures altogether.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a good comment. I agree.
You talked about leaving the Garden of Eden, the mind.
Mm-hmm.
Is any part of your book, or are you thinking of another book about talking about the Promised Land, or you know where they're going after they leave the mind?
I've been toying around with that. I don't think it would be Promised Land or anything like that. I didn't get to it in my lecture, but the Promised Land, when they get there, it's a creative process. They wipe out what was there and create this ideal monarchy, according to the Bible. And that's a creative process. And then that's sort of a parallel of what happened in the original creation. And then it goes down from there. So there's a Promised Land bit there, and actually I do talk about that in the book. What I'm toying with more now is that where do you go from the Hebrew Bible, and in terms of the psychological aspects that you are interested in, and I think that there you start heading into the New Testament with the mythology behind the Christ figure and what that represents. As many of you may know, Carl Jung wrote of Christ, the Christ figure, as a symbol of the self. And so that's interesting when you start looking at the mythology in the New Testament and how it ties in to the self idea. So I think I'm going in that direction right now.
Yeah, interesting to me that I've always made this observation that looking at the story without the filters of religious dogma is, it seems to me that this deity wanted slaves to work under him, dumbed down, stupid, and naked. And the serpent, and this turns the whole story on its head, seems to be the good person, the good entity in the story, because he's trying to free them from this apparent, ignorance and open their eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And he helps them to do that. And if you look at the story, the only one that who really lies in this whole story is Yahweh.
Right.
Because he promised them that if you eat this fruit, he's using fear as a motivator, don't eat this fruit or you're gonna die that very same day, if you take it literally, what he's saying. And they didn't die. Their eyes were opened,
mm-hmm.
Which kind of verified the validity of what the serpent was saying. So it kind of turns the whole thing on its head, seeming that the serpent was the good good aspect and the deity ruling the garden was the negative aspect,
mm-hmm.
or the evil aspect.
Yeah, in the Bible scholars have all long said that the serpent was right, not Yahweh in this case, and that has to do about in what sense did they die that day, and I'm offering a different sort of explanation. But yeah, I mean, the God Yahweh in the Old Testament throughout it is quite a insistent and temperamental God, and I think part of what you see here is just a display of power at the end. And follow me, here's the law, and this is where we're going to establish order in the world. And the serpent, as I mentioned in the talk, has this traditional positive side, which I think was being parodied in the story. And the author, Jay, was emphasizing the chaotic and evil side of the serpent, which is also part of the ancient mythology. And then he's saying, look what happens when this takes hold in the human psyche. So you have to control it. And eventually, Yahweh's law is what's needed.
Jesus dying for our sins never made any sense for me, even though that is what I was taught. I try to instead focus on the resurrection of Jesus, not the death of Jesus. And grace comes from the rise, not the death of Jesus. What is your comment?
Well, the death part of Jesus, the crucifixion, you know, was a big problem for Christians at the beginning because they couldn't explain. It was totally contrary to the Jewish idea of who the Messiah was going to be, and it was a really difficult selling point in early Christianity, and that's why Paul had to get around it, as I described. And, you know, that continues to be a problem for people this day. I mean, some people accept the Paul's explanation, and others don't. The resurrection, I think, has a broader appeal because you can think of it's a joyful idea, and each person can have his own idea of what resurrection involves in terms of spirituality, and it's so deep psychologically that each person's experience of that is going to be different. And you can think of it metaphorically, not necessarily as dying and going to eternal life, but as transitioning into a new stage of being and of your life.
Verse 22, it says, "See that man has become like one of us." Now, obviously, that seems like a reference to a plural deity,
sure,
more than one. Where Yahweh is obviously connotes a singular male patriarchal deity.
Yep.
Can you explain that?
Yeah, that's a legacy from the Canaanite religion. Originally El, who was the chief god in the Canaanite religion, he had a council of gods, of deities, included not just gods, but some goddesses too. And there were like, I think 70 of them actually. And Yahweh merged with and eventually did away with El and became dominant. And so he inherited a lot of those characteristics that El had. One of the inheritances, as I mentioned, was Asherah herself as his wife. But another inheritance was that he had this council of other deities around him. Jay was writing at the very beginning of the biblical literature. And probably at that time, the idea that there were these other deities had not gone away yet. The more pure monotheism came later. And so it wasn't so important that Yahweh be the only deity in existence. The important point for Jay was that he be the dominant one and that he's the only one legitimately deserving worship and veneration. He was the boss, and these others were just his minions.